Welcome to Thinking Out Loud, the podcast that puts you inside conversations with the most deeply passionate, crazy smart, wildly creative, openly collaborative, quietly wise, fabulously funny, intensely dedicated, and yes, the most thoughtful people in our industry. So sit back and stay tuned. They may just change the way you think.
Hello. On today's podcast, I'm speaking with Warren Seeger, co-founder and CEO of Parrot Analytics, which is a data science company that empowers media companies, brands, and agencies to better understand global audience demand for television content. So you're a wealth of information. I'm not quite sure where to start, but why don't we begin by you just telling us a little bit about your vision for the company, why you founded it, and where you're headed with it.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Essentially, what we do is provide the most comprehensive measure of the popularity of TV content around the world. And then we work with content creators, marketers, media companies to help them increase that popularity of their content, again, across all platforms and around the world. Why we founded it is because there is a huge need in an industry that's going through a rapid state of flux, right? So if we see what's happening around us, and this is all driven by technology trends, right? So broadband penetration, broadband speeds. What's happening to the industry now is that you are seeing this rapid proliferation of content distribution platforms. So out here, we talk about Netflix, Amazon, Hulu. There's actually over 600 OTT over-the-top platforms around the world. Today, this is only 2018. Over 600 OTT platforms around the world. And so what's happening is that audiences are now fragmented across all those different platforms. So you watch Stranger Things on Netflix, and you watch Game of Thrones on HBO, and you watch, you know, Mozart in the Jungle on Amazon, etc., right? And you watch Cobra Kai on YouTube Premium and some other TV show on Facebook Watch soon and Instagram TV and what have you. And that fragmentation, what it's leading to is the industry as a whole increasingly understanding less about what is happening across all platforms from a comprehensive point of view. And so that's what we do, is provide that total visibility in terms of how are audiences really engaging and interacting with content and being able to compare that across different platforms.
In the information that I was reading before we met, I noticed that you have a background in science commercialization.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, so I think the biggest advances in human history have always been a combination of three things: science, technology, and entrepreneurship. And so you think of anything, that the electricity, the internet, the car, any major invention that's disrupted society needed to have three factors. It needed to have science to invent it, needed to have technology to apply the science. So people think technology and science are synonymous. They're not. Technology is the application of scientific research. And it needed to have entrepreneurship to commercialize that technology to the wider market. So that's what science commercialization is. It's a combination of those three things.
And part of what you're doing with Parrot Analytics is trying to connect content creators with consumers.
That's our mission, yeah.
So does
that
mean you
have... That's the real why we do it. Yeah.
Okay, so does that mean you have the secret sauce for how to create a success?
I wouldn't say so. I would say that we provide the science to an existing art of creating hits, right? And it's always been an art. We don't try to replace that art. We want to complement it with the science to maximize the odds of creating something that audiences will really love and enjoy and helping creators reach their intended audiences.
So we hear a lot about data analytics.
Sure.
Driving the creation of content these days. Netflix is widely discussed as being excellent at it. You know, we know what you watch, we know how you react to what you watch, and therefore we know what to create to get you to watch more of it. Is that a good encapsulation of what Parrot Analytics is also helping to inform?
Yeah, so our mission is to connect creators and consumers, right? And we want to do that by enabling data-driven decisions along the value chain of content. The process isn't as robotic as it sounds in that one statement, right, that says, we know what you watch, we know how you react to it, and therefore we know how you will respond to something new that we create. The process is more about providing parameters to drive these decisions to enable the industry to minimize waste and inefficiency. So some quick numbers to help sort of provide some context. $800 billion is spent on television content around the world. $800 billion. That's everything from content investment, content production, distribution, marketing, advertising, and TV advertising alone in the United States only is a $100 billion market. And so that's almost a $1 trillion industry. It's one of the largest industries out there. And it's probably hands down the least data-driven industry out there, given its size. And so...
Now stop there for a second.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, case in point, 65% of new network TV shows in the United States are canceled in the first season. The industry today is having the highest cancellation rates ever. So it's not a question of having more data. The industry today has more data than ever before, right? There is so much data out there right now. And yet, there's so much failure out there right now. In fact, more than there ever has been.
Well, now, there are two ways to look at that. You can say that there's more failure, or you can say that there's more experimentation. Is it a good thing that networks are tossing out more content and likely to say, oh, that's not working, or let's replace it with this, or let's move in
a
different direction?
That's very expensive experimentation.
That's very true.
So, I think the industry would like to. I don't think you would come across an executive that would say, oh, I would rather, waste $20 million experimenting on a hit that I thought was going to be a hit, but ended up not being a hit, as opposed to actually I can look at some insights to prevent that waste.
So to your point, there's more data than ever before. Are we just not using it right?
Well, there's more data, but less insights. And I think that's where a lot of people in the industry, because there's a lot of buzz out there, big data. And data and insights are not synonymous. You can have a lot of data, but very little insights. And so a large part of what we do is actually work with the industry to help them understand that it's not about just, yes, truly we process 1 trillion data points a day from 249 countries around the world. That's every country on the planet and so on. But that's all buzz, so to speak, right? What people really want to know, if I'm a marketer and I'm going to spend $10 to try to reach the audiences for a program that I'm working on, how should I spend that $10? And if you answer that question, that's all the insights that you need to make that specific decision.
So I'm a marketer. When I'm talking to colleagues deep into the marketing community, I very often, obviously we end up talking about big data and the use of analytics, and I very often hear that we are now so inundated with data that it's harder to cull out the insights and identify the key insights that should be the strategic drivers of decision-making, both for building the business and for building the brand.
Very true.
So I think that's what you're speaking to. So help us understand a little bit about what Parrot Analytics brings to the table in the area of insights to help make that easier and more effective.
So let's start from the top. I mentioned that what we do is we provide the most comprehensive measure of the popularity of TV content around the world. And the way we do that...
Across
all platforms around the world. And the way we do that is by going out and capturing all the different ways that people express what we call demand for content, right? And so next question is, what is demand for content? And demand for content is, well, if I see, let's take a personal journey to illustrate. If I, I'm driving down Santa Monica Boulevard and I see a billboard of a TV show, the first thing I'll do if it intrigues me is I'll pull out my phone and then I will search for it. I'll Google it. That's signal number one. I'm expressing demand for it. What is the first thing that usually shows up when you search for something like a TV show? An IMDb page usually, or a YouTube trailer maybe. So I might watch a trailer and go, oh, I wonder if I like this show. And then if it really intrigues me, I want to find out more about it before I invest the time to watch it. I might go on its Wikipedia page and read about it. These are all signals of demand for content, right? At various stages of your intent to consume the content. Some people go all the way and say, I really want to watch this, but I don't have the platform that it's airing on, or I can't afford it, or it's too hard, or it doesn't even air in my market right now, And so they go and download it off the Pirate Bay, or they stream it off a Popcorn Time or some illegitimate website. These are all signals of demand for content. Now, later on, people may go into social media and discuss it. And of course, that's been around for a while, and this has been playing with social media data for a lot of time. And these are all signals of demand. So what we do is we say, all right, let's capture as many of those signals as possible. That's search data, that's, you know, trailer views, that's social media, blogging, microblogging, peer-to-peer downloads, you know, BitTorrent streams, Popcorn Time streams, you know, legitimate file sharing websites and peer-to-peer network streaming data, and combine everything together. Let's figure out a system that can merge all those signals together and combine them into a single metric that tells you this is how much demand there is for this specific program today, right?
Measuring demand is really different than measuring ratings.
Yes.
Because what you're saying is you can track and aggregate demand, which is interest.
Yes.
Which is actually more valuable to content creators than what people are able to find and commit to watching. Because there's a they might be interested in a lot more than they actually are able to
consume.
Locate and
Correct.
Consume.
Correct.
And you're measuring what interests them and what they would like to find and watch.
Not only that, but using the methodology that we do, you're able to, for example, let's say that, you know, I'm a fan of Japanese animes, right? I may like a new anime that's just been released somewhere in the world, but it hasn't yet aired here in the United States, right? Like, no one has bought the rights to that TV show here. So I may go and express a lot of demand for it, but there are no ratings for it here. It doesn't air anywhere. So there's a lot of differences between like measuring just the retrospective ratings of what has happened, what aired on TV, as opposed to understanding the demand for all content in all languages across all platforms. I do want to come back to your point about how, you know, your marketing colleagues are just drowning with so much data, right?
Yeah.
Overwhelmed. And so come back to that question, now that we have the context about how we do what we do in terms of plugging into all those platforms and combining them into a single metric, we provide a layer of simplicity. And then, you know, above all that complexity, a layer of simplicity for marketers to be able to drive actionable decisions. For example, so, you know, I'd walk into the chief marketing officer of a major US network, and, you know, she would be drowning in data signals. We have 20 screens on the wall, you know, here's our YouTube channels, here's how they're doing, and here's our all of our like Snapchat campaigns and our Facebook campaigns, and, you know, and here's how we're doing here and there and so on. And a lot of these metrics are conflicting. They're telling you different signals, they're telling you different stories, and it's so hard to actually understand, okay, what is happening for our brand, if we care about a brand, being a television show, for example. What's happening with that brand and how our audience is reacting to it? And so, for example, one of the things that we do is, because we plug into all those sources and then we combine them together into a single metric, we provide a single measure of truth of the demand for that content. Now, as a marketer, you want to always increase the demand for the content. And again, one of the amazing things that we can do is actually measure the demand leading to the launch of a particular program, right? So you can only have ratings once it airs. And for a lot of TV networks, once the TV show airs, it's too late to do anything as a marketer. Like, some networks' share price is either going up or down if their big hit premieres goes badly. What you want to know is, what is that demand 8 weeks out before you premiere, and how is it changing, and how are your marketing campaigns driving up that demand? And where it gets really interesting is actually, you know, going back to the sort of my example about simple actionability, is you're a marketer, you have $10 to spend on this new program that you're launching on your network. How do you spend that $10? Do you run campaigns on Facebook? Do you run campaigns on YouTube? And of course, as a CMO, now you're getting bombarded by sales pitches. All these digital platforms, salespeople are coming to you and saying, come run your campaigns with us. We provide you the best access to your audiences and so on. Of course, they all have the same, you know, they're all the best things since sliced bread. So what you want to find out is, for my specific brand, what is the most effective medium for me to reach my audiences? And again, because we plug into all those sources and combine them together, we can do that. We can say, hey, let's run an A-B test. How about you spend 5 cents of your $10 across these 6 different marketing channels, digital platforms, or billboards even, and then let's measure the impact of each of those campaigns on the demand for your brand. And then that way you can very quickly discover that, hey, for this particular brand, you know, running marketing campaigns on channel A is the most effective medium. And for this other brand, running marketing campaigns on channel B is the most effective medium.
You're probably listening to this podcast because you're a smart, busy executive who wants to keep up with the latest news and trends efficiently. And you're probably also a CTAM Smart Brief subscriber. Did you say no? Then you're missing out on the finest industry news briefing, deftly delivered daily to your inbox. Like I said, it's smart, it's brief, it's always free, and read by thousands of leaders like you. Sign up today at smartbrief.com/CTAM.
So let's talk about brands.
Sure.
For a minute. There's a question that fascinates me, and that is the balance of importance now between network brands and program brands. Mm. So you're measuring demand and interest, but how much does a network's brand equity come into play and what attracts viewer attention and interest versus a program? More and more consumer behavior is shifting towards programming.
Yes.
You know, people watch programs.
Correct.
But there used to be a time where the framework that a network provided gave people a comfort zone in which to find programs that they thought they would be more likely to enjoy based on past experience. With the proliferation of platforms today, that's eroding a bit, and content is everywhere, TV everywhere. So what are you seeing across the analytics landscape?
Yeah, we're on the content-centric side of the equation. So we're very content-centric because, to your point, audiences are now increasingly going and finding the content that they like as opposed to that network brand that they're loyal to. And there's certainly still a lot of network loyalty out there. We're just seeing that drive less and less of consumer consumption and what they're demanding, as opposed to, you know, your best friend told you that you really got to check out this new TV show because it's the best and you'll like it. And your next job is to find out where that TV show is and access it, regardless of what network it's
on. That's right. I mean, media marketers today are facing the challenge of people need to be aware of what's out there and they need to know how to find it.
How to find it.
And so you're helping them with the awareness part of the equation. Are you also helping them with the how to find it part of the equation?
Yeah. So for example, one of the things that we do with our OTT platform clients is actually support their discovery and recommendation engines. And large platforms like Netflix and Hulu have publicly come out and said that 70% of all the consumption on a given day happens off home screen recommendations, right? So 70% of what consumers watch when they turn on one of these OTT platforms is what the platform recommends to them. And so increasingly, we're beginning to trust these recommendations if they're good, right? But oftentimes they're really bad. And so one of the things that we do is drive that algorithmic recommendations as well. From a human marketing point of view, again, the real decision that they have to make is how do I invest my resources, being my time and money, to most effectively reach my consumer, my intended audience. And that's what we help with. We help them understand that your intended audience for this particular program lives on that tiny little niche digital platform. Or actually, they're really into, you know, that offline type of activity. So that's the most effective way to reach them.
There's a lot of discussion today around artificial intelligence. Mm. I know that at Parrot, you work with a groundbreaking AI platform. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that and what that looks like.
Yeah, so it's nothing scary, as a lot of people like to make it out to be. It's just a way of processing really large volumes of data really quickly, right? So we process over 1 billion data points a day from around the world.
Billion a day worldwide.
Yeah. Now, you can't put 1 billion data points on an Excel spreadsheet. It breaks. It breaks after a few million rows. Okay.
I've never broken an Excel spreadsheet. So.
Yeah. Well, you can really easily break it, right? Mm-hmm. So, like when people talk about like AI, it's a couple of things. One is there's just really large data volume processing, data engineering and processing, so you're able to combine all those signals. Because when I say, you know, we plug into like searches and torrent, you know, and tweets and everything, each of those individual types of activities are like millions and millions of data points, really, really deep data sets. And so when you talk about AI, one is just processing the data, but two is then extracting insights from that data. again, in a way that is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to be done manually, because it's just the volumes of data are so large, they're so deep, and they're so wide that you need to know what you're looking for to extract a piece of insight. So what, you know, what our data scientists do then is build these algorithms, build these models that are able to automatically go out and find what we want to find in the data.
And is it an evolutionary program? Does it learn as it goes?
Yes, and that's one of the unique features of, you know, the new machine learning systems, is that, and you know, neural networks have been around for more than 20 years, but it's just, again, now with the computational power that's increasing, we're able to process much larger data sets through them and train the models much more quickly than we were able to in the past. And so the system learns and improves over time. That, you know, for example, we have a, to make this sort of more tangible, we have a system that we call demand rank. And what a demand rank system, it's a machine learning system that assigns a weighting to the various types of consumer expressions according to how much demand that expression represents. For example, between the two of us, we can probably agree that if I watch three back-to-back episodes of a TV show, I'm expressing more demand for that TV show than if I press like on his Facebook page, right?
Sure, you've invested your personal time.
I invested 3 hours of my time watching that show, right? And then the latter action took me a split second. I may have even done it by accident.
Which is a momentary reaction and may not even be a real read on your interest.
It tells you nothing, or it's a passive impression. It may tell you something at volume, I don't know. So we built a system that's able to assign a weighting to each interaction. So you watch a trailer, well, how much is that worth? Because we had to find a way to combine all the signals into a single metric, right? So you watch a trailer, well, you're expressing demand for that content. What if you read a Wikipedia page? You're also expressing demand for that content. You're engaging with it. You're reading about its background, its fictional characters, etc. Its universe. But how do you combine a trailer view with a Wikipedia page view? What do they tell you? As a marketer, they tell you different things. And so we had to figure out a system to be able to assign a meaning to each individual activity at scale. So that's one of the machine learning systems where we set the parameters and then the system learns over time that actually, you know, Facebook's likes, and I'm just using that as an example, like don't correlate with anything. They don't correlate with subsequent viewing. They don't correlate with where you spend your money. So I'm going to assign them less and less weight. So the system evolves and learns over time.
Right now in the industry, across the media landscape, there's a lot of talk about international growth. And you and I have used the word global and worldwide a couple of times in terms of talking about your business.
Yeah, we use it a lot, yeah.
I'm seeing a shift among our ecosystem of marketers now reporting into the international heads. Yesterday on stage at TCA, David Zaslav pointed out that he's appointed a global head of Animal Planet and said that he believes their model for the future will be one person programming a network globally as opposed to having a separate international head. So we're seeing the lines blur of the business coming together. And of course, the OTT landscape eliminates the geographic boundaries altogether.
As of Q1 this year, Netflix has more international subscribers than domestic subscribers.
There you go. So you have this incredible worldwide view of the media landscape. Are you seeing cultural differences? Are you seeing trends or information that would help guide the industry in its evolution towards becoming more of a global entity?
Absolutely. And I think, again, it's largely driven by the internet. So when we plotted where all the trends were heading 6 years ago, it was really clear that the industry, as most other content industries, have just gone global because it's so easy to access content now from the other side of the world with three clicks on a laptop. So we're seeing the industry become more global. We're seeing audiences become more global in where they find content from and where they pull it from. But at the same time, we are seeing the industry become more localized as well. And that local nuances are now more important than ever to stand out in a local market. So I'll give you a couple examples. So we've developed this metric because we have this global data sets. We developed this metric that we call travelability. And travelability is a metric that we assign to TV content to help the content creators and marketers behind it understand its likelihood to travel around the world, right? To help them understand its monetization potential and so on. And we are seeing travelability for content that you wouldn't even think was possible. So, for example, we were one of the first to, in fact, we were the first to break 18 months ago that Skam, a Norwegian drama, was really popular in the United States. And that was weird at the time because Skam aired in Norway and a bunch of Scandinavian markets. The TV show had no English subtitles, was in Norwegian. It offered no English subtitles. And yet it was popular in the United States, in Canada and Australia, the UK. And so you go, that doesn't make sense. How could a Norwegian show with no English subtitles be popular in the United States? The show doesn't even air here. At the time, it didn't air here. It didn't have English subtitles. It's just, it's a local show in a local market. And the show had an innovative format, so a lot of people within its intended audiences, younger audiences, loved it, and they were very passionate about it. Some hyperfans watched the show, who are bilingual, and created their own subtitles. They slapped it on top of the TV show and then re-uploaded it online. So now you could go to Popcorn Time or to the Pirate Bay or any one of your choice of, you know, online streaming sites that consumers do use to this day and age, again, because of, I think the industry hasn't really caught up in terms of content distribution, though it's getting there. But American audiences then found the show and started watching it. And so it traveled. And 6 months ago, I think Simon Phillips picked it up here for a US adaptation. But that wouldn't have happened had US audiences not caught on to it, even before the show made the travel, made the jump here.
So technology is enabling us to create fan communities in very global ways. And you're able to identify and track
even
the
in unintended
within
ways,
those,
yeah.
And even in unintended ways. So you've just touched on a topic that's very big to the industry, which is piracy.
Yes.
And we are behind in addressing that. So what intelligence and ability does Parrot Analytics bring to that part of the business equation?
Yeah, so look, this is a topic that makes a lot of people in the industry cringe.
Right? And crazy, yes.
for good reason. I'll tell you a personal story and then I'll come back to your question because I think it's relevant. So often is demonized, right? And it's costing the industry billions of dollars, and it's no doubt costing the industry a lot of money, and the industry needs to catch up. But I grew up in New Zealand. I'm a Kiwi. And in New Zealand, oftentimes content, up until very recently, even now, some content does not air day and date with its US airing date. And if you're a fan of a new TV show, you had to wait 3 months, 6 months until whoever the network that's carrying it in New Zealand had the airing rights, the window to window there. So real life story, Game of Thrones, season 2, I believe, I think at the time, 6 months after the US airing date. And we know the folks who aired New Zealand really well. And, you know, I, as a fan of the show, I'm out there going, okay, the season finale just aired in the US. Okay. I'm 10 episodes behind already. Take my money. I want someone to take my money and give me the show so I can watch it. I'll buy it. But you literally couldn't. You can't buy it. You can't spend your money to access the content. It's not available. It is not legally available for you to consume. Now, I have two choices as a consumer. And, you know, I said this to the CEO of networks that, who are our clients. I'm like, take my money. You know, they're like, we just can't. We don't have the rights to. And so I say, okay, CEO of Network X in New Zealand, I'm gonna pirate your show that before you air it because I have two choices. Either I pirate it now and I watch it, or I don't consume it at all. So I've been on record in the industry saying I've pirated content before, not because I don't want to pay for it, but because it was literally, the alternative was to not watch it at all.
I have never heard anyone use passion as a driver for piracy before. I think you make a very interesting point. And when you turn the prism, that isn't necessarily a negative thing. It just poses a challenge that the content developers need to address, because if they really want to fuel the passion for their content, they need to figure out how to make it available to all as quickly as possible in a fair commercial way.
Not everyone who pirates content pirates it because they don't want to pay for it. As an industry, I think our challenge is to make sure that the content is easily available, accessible, and convenient for consumers. If it's not easily available, if it's not accessible, if it's inconvenient for consumers, we can't expect them to go through 20 different hoops to reach our content or to wait in just an unreasonable amount of time to access it. If they're really they're already fans, they're treasure. And so that's our challenge as an industry.
And we're solving for that challenge
increasingly,
more effectively domestically than internationally. And I love your New Zealand story, because I think we need to think more internationally as we start to look at consumer behavior and access, because it is becoming more and more universal.
And even then, even domestically, you know, a lot of content still doesn't reach the United States. So you could be a fan of a BBC drama, right? A British drama that just doesn't air here or hasn't been sold in the US yet, but it's already 6 episodes in the UK. And so you travel to London, your friends in London are all talking about it. You watch a couple of episodes there while you're in London. You get hooked on it. You come back to LA and you can't continue watching the show. Right? Now, suddenly, again, you're faced with a choice as a consumer. What do? You don't want to go out and quote unquote steal it, but the alternative is you're not watching it as a consumer. So, you know, again, this doesn't say it's a positive thing, but it's providing context as to why it's happening and what we need to do about it as an industry. So come back to the original question, where we come out of it here is that we provide those insights, that intelligence, that here are where people really want that content.
So just taking a little turn here, are the digital platforms, or Google, Apple, Facebook, Snap, and others, is that the new TV? Is that where people then start to go to seek out YouTube? You mentioned a number of times. Is that the new TV?
I think it's going to be a hybrid model, right? TV networks are not going anywhere anytime soon. But I think very soon we're going to stop referring to digital as digital, right? It's just everything we have is digital now. We spend half of our waking hours every single day on digital screens. And so, yes, it is the new way of consuming content, but it doesn't mean that, quote unquote, the old way of doing content is going anywhere anytime soon. So, for example, you know, a couple of years ago, we heard so much about everything becoming more mobile, right? And mobile viewing, and everyone is like, you know, optimizing for mobile viewing. And increasingly now, again, the likes of Netflix and Hulu and other platforms have publicly come out and have said that viewing may start, like you may subscribe to an SVOD service on your mobile phone or on your laptop, but you'll come back to your TV to watch it, right? Whether it's your smart TV, whether you'll hook up your laptop to your TV to watch it, you'll come back because you want to watch it on TV. So the experience doesn't change. The medium is not going to, the watching medium is not going to change, but the delivery medium is going to change as everything becomes more over the top. And again, keep in mind, this is only 2018. We're still on really bad, like 3G and 4G in some cases. As fast forward 3-4 years in the future, we have 5G, 6G now, with extendable mobile devices and, you know, seamless connectivity with our TV screens. Yeah, that's going to be the new norm.
The future's very exciting. It's happening very quickly. The future isn't what it used to be. It's a lot closer to us, but it is coming at us very fast, very furious. So if you could leave us with one or two thoughts to help us get from where we are to where we need to be to keep up with that pace of change, what are they?
So I think probably the one thought I think that would summarize the state of flux that's happening right now is that the currency or the bottleneck to reaching audiences, right? Previously, in the previous model of content distribution to audiences, the bottleneck was distribution. You needed to, as a TV program, you need to get picked up by a network to have your content distributed. Now you can go direct to consumer through a whole number of hosts of platforms. The new bottleneck is consumer attention. And I think as marketers, if we keep that in mind, that the new currency is consumer attention. And everyone is vying for attention. Not just competing programs and competing networks. Everything is vying for our attention as consumers. If I watch a cat video on YouTube, I'm not watching your TV show. You're competing with that. If I'm playing a game, I'm not watching your TV show. If I'm listening to music, I'm not watching your TV show. Everything is vying for our attention in this day and age. Because it's a proliferated environment, we can spend our attention in so many different ways right now. And so the new bottleneck and currency is consumer attention. So a lot of the work that we do with the industry is actually helping them understand what is the most effective medium to capture that attention. And who are you really competing against for your particular program? Because it might not be who you think it is.
Well, you've done a remarkable job capturing our attention. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.